Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time. Turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with the Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. And they're all tough, sir. We understand that. No matter if you lead in the second half, come back in the second half. Last two home games, you've had your opportunities, as Coach Rizzi will say, we had opportunities, but kind of in the end, you know, it's about the final score and your record, and that's just challenging.
Yeah, look, every loss is a tough loss. And when you walk away with a win, no matter how you got it, you're going to have a smile on your face and you're going to feel good about yourself. And if you lose, then you're going to spend, the next 24 hours in the tank. And then you got to get over it and move on to the next game.
So there's three games left. And, when you kind of look at this season, and, it's not, you fight until they tell you you can't fight anymore. I get that, man. But one score games, it feels like that has become the NFL. You guys were involved in one score games in 3, 4, 9, 10, 13, 14, and week 15. I mean, those typically tell the difference between, how things will turn out, correct?
Yeah, well, look, I think we've had 8 one-score games. I think we're 2-6 in those games. For example, Kansas City, I think they've had 10 one-score games, and they're 10-0. And so, and then everyone in our league is on that spectrum, right? And the teams that have good records for the most part in those one-score games, and the other ones don't. And look, it comes down to the one-score games come down to one or two plays in a game that you make or they make. And we haven't made enough of those plays in a lot of those games. And, I look back at this game. I look back at Atlanta, the first Atlanta game, the Philadelphia game. I mean, we're one play away from having a win instead of a loss, and in the season, we're looking at the season completely differently. And that's typically the case every year. But I think for the most part, those one-score games end up being 50-50 on the season. And you need to at least be that to give yourself a chance, and we're not.
And, there's a lot of character and a lot of gut, in that game. I mean, and the Washington takes the third quarter, second half drive. They get a field goal, but it takes 6:48. So, they're up 17-0. The time of possession at that point is 27 minutes to 9:52. And Spencer Rattler hadn't taken a snap yet, but he's getting ready to come into the game. And that game could have gone a bunch of different directions at that juncture. And 4 possessions in the second half, 2 touchdowns, 2 field goals. Again, I understand that the fans are upset. I get all that. But in the building, it's about evaluation and character and not quitting. And I mean, you saw all of that on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, look, at that point in the game, the juncture you talked about, the game was only going one direction, and it was down. let's not kid ourselves. And yet, man, our coaches and players found a way to reach down inside and display some grit and some toughness and to keep fighting. And you know, when you do that, you know, good things can happen. And look, we gave ourselves a chance to win the game at the end, and unfortunately, we won by short.
The defense, you know, if you kind of look at just the numbers against Jaden Daniels, I mean, it was kind of not feast or famine, but 8 sacks, 6 quarterback hits. But and we can talk about the running and the impact of those big run plays, but and his ball placement for a rookie just seemed exceptional on Sunday.
Yeah, look, he did a nice job. He was 25 of 31. I think there was a large portion of the game where he was like only 2 incompletions. You know, a lot of them were short passes. You know, things that the defense forced him to do. Check down and do some things. He did some good things with his legs. You know, none of that's unexpected. But I thought our defense did a really good job of keeping their offense contained for the most part. But listen, you know, great players are going to make, they're going to make some plays, you know, and you have to counter with, you know, good plays of your own. So I don't think anything that he did was unexpected. Look, he's got great poise. Great poise in particular for a rookie quarterback, and they've done a great job coaching him, and they've got, you know, good players around him, and that's why they've got a good record.
We'll have more with Saints Executive VP and General Manager Mickey Loomis when we come back. And a little later in the show, we'll have former Saints tight end and now SEC analyst Ben Watson. A lot to talk about on both the NFL and collegiate fronts. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.
We are talking with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. I don't know what you can say definitively. I know there's 3 games left. Derek Carr's reexamination. He might get back, might not get back, but it may look now like he, you know, take each game as they come, but it feels like it's a little more serious.
Well, look, he's going to be day to day, really, you know, and he's got an issue in his hand, and there's reason to be optimistic, but it's a day to day thing. We just have to go along and see, you know, when he gets to the point where he can function well enough to play in the game. I know he wants to play, and when he can, he will.
So the 2nd and 6 and manageable becomes 2nd and 11. Alvin is the deep back and now goes in motion back to throw as Rattler steps up, throws it across the middle, looking for Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who comes up with the catch at the 20-yard line. Wow, good coverage by Washington. He misses the easy ones, but made the hard one, and wow.
And I don't know how he got this football. I mean, he's focused on it. You've got one safety that's bearing down to make the interception, and the defender, you know, I don't even think he saw the football, but, I mean, you're exactly right. Your quarterback climbs the pocket, and he trusts, hey, I'm gonna see if my guy can make a play, and he definitely made the play for him.
Here we go.
I'm looking for my back. I'm looking for my back in the flat.
One play.
If I can't have some type of rub route here, that's what I'm looking for.
Spencer Rattler out of the shotgun. Looks to throw, stands, does throw. Caught, corner of the end zone, and that's Foster Moreau. The Saints have climbed all the way back, but not yet. They're down 1.
And they're going for 2.
What did you learn about Spencer Rattler Sunday?
Yeah, I think that, a lot of times when you come into a game, you know, you don't have a lot of time to think. You're in there and you're just playing. And I thought that, you know, he did that. He came in, he made some plays. I thought he was poised. And look, he made a couple throws that could have gone either way, but they were good throws, and we had guys on the other end making plays for him, and it was good. It was good outing. It was good for him, good for his confidence, and he provided a spark for us that we needed.
And so moving forward, so as again, you fight until you can't fight anymore, until they tell you you are out. And I would normally say, well, you really want to take a look at some of the younger players, but you look at Kool-Aid and Fuaga and really Bub means some, but at some point, you know, you're going to get a look at Jalen Ford now because DeMarco Jackson's been hurt. There really isn't, other than maybe the quarterback situation where you go, all right, what do we have in Jake Haener and Spencer Rattler if Derek doesn't go, right? I mean, those other guys, Jalen Ford, maybe Christian Boyd, but everybody else is playing because of the injury situation. Do you need these final three games, hypothetically, if Derek doesn't go, to kind of see where you are with these two young quarterbacks?
Well, I would say that, number one, we're going to try to win every game. That's what we're here for. We're going to do everything we can to win every single game. We don't have much of an option in terms of, you know, playing young guys and evaluating the other guys on our roster. We've just had this avalanche of injuries that have happened over the course of this season, and we've had to play a lot of guys that, you know, we didn't have an expectation that they would play as much on offense and defense. It's been forced upon us. And obviously, if they're playing, you get an opportunity to evaluate them, and they get an opportunity to develop. And there's a lot to play for. There's a lot of development to play for that we still have a chance. And so we're going to give everything that we've got as an organization, and our players and coaches are going to do the same.
Got another little sample size of Kendre Miller Sunday as well, especially on that final drive. Your thoughts?
Yeah, look, we know Kendre is a talented runner, and the only thing that's held him back to date is just opportunity, an opportunity given some of the injuries that he's had. So it was good to see him get out there, have some success. He had 9 carries for, you know, roughly 50 yards at the, you know, 5-yard plus average. That's good running. He made yards after contact. He did some good things, and you know, there's some things that he needs to improve upon. And this will be an opportunity going forward for him to get, you know, on field experience. It's a big deal for him. This is it's a big deal for all of these players that are playing to play well and develop and help determine their future.
So here's a tough one, and I'm not trying to be coy, but is there any question, realistically, that I could ask about the coaching situation, the search, that wouldn't really we get an answer of like, it's a process. We're in that process, right? I'm trying to figure out what the question would be of them. What is, you know, where does it stand?
Yeah, well, that's a process that's going to happen after the season's over. We're going to focus our attention on this week's game against Green Bay, and then the following two games, and the, you know, the coaching search will happen. After the season, I want to be fair to our coaching staff and to Darren Rizzi, who's, I think, doing a fantastic job. And, you know, we'll deal with next year after the season's over.
Need to take a break. We'll have more with Mickey Loomis, Saints Executive VP and General Manager, when we come back. Talk a little bit about Monday Night Football at Lambeau Field. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.
6 of 8 are the Commanders on third down. To throw is Daniels. Now he's got some pressure, and he's going to get caught and brought down by Ugo Amadi, who just stood in front of him and would not let him in. Darren Rizzi races down the line to get that timeout, just as Deuce asked for it. But wow, Ugo, he just kind of stood in front of him and was like, nope.
He stood, and then I'm just going to hold you. You know, I'm gonna almost like hold you up. And so you're bigger than me. You're way bigger than me. And so the Saints did bring pressure. They showed simulated pressure, and the extra guy came off the edge. And so Ugo was one of those extra guys off of the edge. And, you know, the Saints have had some success against Jaden Daniels. He's had a lot of time back there, and so it looks like pressure, but it ends up being 4, but it's an overload to one side. And so you talk about having, what, 5 sacks?
Yeah, 5 sacks. That one was for 14 yards.
Just a couple of more questions with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. Tell me about a little bit more about Ugo Amadi. I know he's an Oregon kid, so I know automatically you love him. But wow, you know, week one doesn't play, week two, seven defensive snaps, plays in week eight. But in his last, you know, since week 10, you know, a sack, 41 tackles, 31 solo, four tackles for a loss, five passes defense. You know, he's 5'9", you know, 201. He just seems to, he's like one of those, he's a football player. He's one of those guys that just plays football.
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, I am a little biased because he isn't from the University of Oregon, so you know, my affinity for that place. But, you know, here's a guy who's a smart player. He's almost always in the right place at the right time, knows what to do, knows how to do it, is coachable. He's going to give you everything he has, every single moment that he's on the field. And, you know, that lends itself to making plays, and he's done that. And we've got, you know, he's not the only one. We've got a number of guys that have had to fill in and have done a good job. I think that, you know, Alante was playing at a high level as the nickel and has had to move outside because of the injuries, and he's done really good work out there. Kool-Aid's, you know, come in as a rookie, and man, he's improved every week. So I think that, you know, it speaks to the effort and the ability of these guys to step in and do a job when maybe they didn't expect to have to do that. But you're absolutely right about Ugo. He's done a fantastic job for us, and man, I'm glad we have him.
And finally, and Coach Rizzi said this, man, if you can't get up for Monday Night Football in December at Lambeau Field, but who knows, 20s, 30s, snow, I mean, this is what kind of football is all about here, irrespective of the records. You want to be better, and it's an important game for them. You're going to get the best that they have.
Yeah, look, it's we've had some good battles with the Packers in recent years, and you know, it seems like we're always playing the game at their place, so
that's true.
It's nice to be able to play one or two of those in the Superdome. But yeah, it's going to be a good environment. It's always a great environment at Lambeau Field, and Monday Night Football, you know, we won't have to worry about motivation. Our guys will be ready to go, and we'll see what happens.
And last time you were there, one score game. So we'll see. We appreciate it, Mickey. Best of luck and continued success through the holidays.
Thank you, Mike. Take care.
Let's pause 10 seconds to let stations identify themselves here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. When we return, we'll talk to former Saints and New England Patriots tight end Ben Watson, author, father of seven, SEC analyst, getting his master's, and yes, that and more. When we come back on the Saints Hour here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. We are joined now by Ben Watson, former New Orleans Saints tight end, New England tight end, 16 years in the NFL. I want to say hello first, because if I start getting into your resume, the show will be over. So welcome to the show, first off.
Hey, it's great to be here with you, Mike. Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas to you and everybody else.
Thank you. You are, where are you?
Right now, I am at home, right outside Atlanta, Georgia. We're about 25 minutes south of the airport in an area called Palmetto, Georgia.
Sure. So let me get back to the intro, because it's important. You were born in the Commonwealth of Virginia, like myself, in Norfolk.
There you go.
And so two-time Walter Payton nominee. Are you still working on the degree of public administration at American, or is that over?
I am. I completed my first year. I took a break during the football season while I'm doing SEC Network. I'm about to pick up class again January the 6th.
I think you'll be all right, because you're an author of three books. You run the Watson 7 Foundation. And if you're wondering why it's the Watson 7 Foundation, you and your wife, Kirsten, have seven children. And so I'm amazed by you, and I'm hacked off by you, because I can't do anything, and I only have two kids, and I don't have near the stuff on my plate as you do. But so I'm just teasing. I'm amazed at what you do, as well as college football analyst for the SEC. How do you fit it all in?
I don't do it well all the time, Mike, to be honest with you. It's been a work in progress. Been working with the SEC for 4 years now, and so it has been. I tell you what. One of the things about getting out of the NFL is learning how to manage your time. And so that's been a process, but we got a hold of it now.
So 16-year NFL career, drafted by New England in 2004. And I
I'm always amazed about a lot of the guys with, you know, when you look at years in the NFL, and most of them are kickers. They're not looking like you. And I know, I can't, without even guessing, you know that Mercedes Lewis is a stud of his. That, to me, is just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, Mercedes, he's one of those guys that, I mean, I think he's on, what, year 19 or 20 now, something ridiculous. It helps the fact that he's just bigger than everybody. And you know what they tell you as tight ends, you always want to catch passes, score touchdowns. And I remember a guy named Daniel Graham who came with the Saints for about a year, I think. But when I first got in the league, he was with New England, played under him for like 2 years. And he told me, if you want to stay in this league for a long time, learn how to block. It's not flashy. You're not going to be on the ticker on SportsCenter. You ain't going to have no highlights. But if you want to play for a long time, learn how to block. And I tell you, that's what Mercedes Lewis does so well is block. I mean, nobody can get around the guy.
Is that what you were told when you arrived in New England in 2004 with Mr. Belichick?
It is, and I sucked at it. I was terrible at it. I got better as time went on, but I just wanted to make the flashy plays. But I tell you, during different times in my career, even when I came to New Orleans, you know, playing behind Jimmy Graham, you know, a guy who, man, I still look at as one of the best to ever play the position. As sometimes in your career, you catch the passes, and sometimes you got to block.
So we're going to talk about college football in a second, but I've got you on the, you know, I've got this great guest and I've got questions. And so the torn Achilles, where you missed 2016, you at the time, you'd already played 12 years. You're at age 36. You've got Super Bowl rings. And it's 2016 to me is not a long time ago, but in the world of medical and Achilles tendons, it might as well be 30 years. The decision and during that time to come, you miss all of 2016. You could have said, you know, end of the sunset. What was it that drove you to come back?
Well, a couple of things, Mike. Number one, I had a contract, so I had another left on the contract. And I knew I was going to rehab anyway. You know, the thing about playing sports is when you have some of those injuries and the Achilles, I've had several, but the Achilles was the most devastating injury that I sustained because it really changes much of your life, even moving forward. But I knew I was going to try to rehab as if I wanted to play. I wanted to get to as healthy as possible as if I was going to play. And then it's a situation of, you know, I wanted my kids who sat there with me every night and prayed for daddy and his Achilles to see me overcome adversity and to be able to tell them, man, daddy was down and out. He couldn't walk. He had to learn how to walk again. He's still not the same. He still got issues to this day because of the Achilles, but he fought back and played. And I also wanted, look, I was leaving New Orleans in 2015, went to Baltimore. And it's tough when you come into a system, a new city, and you get injured because part of you wants to prove yourself. You want to prove to your teammates that, you know, you can play and that they can rely on you. So it's kind of all those factors. And you want to prove it to yourself that you can come back at that age and play.
So you play with New England. You've had two different stints with New Orleans, 2013 to 2015, then 2018, and also Baltimore. I'm not discounting your years in Cleveland. They were awesome. They are a great franchise. But when you play for New England and New Orleans and Baltimore, you have played in organizations where winning culture is demanded. It is just, it's there. But, you know, people talk about it a lot. And, you know, I remember in your head, when I say winning culture, what does that mean?
It starts at the top. Winning culture starts with accountability. It starts with ownership. Secondly, it goes to GMs, coaches. There has to be a sort of structure. It's kind of like building a house. We recently built a home, and it was a crazy process, but we built a home. We hope to live here for a very long time after moving around a lot. And it always starts with the foundation. And if you don't have a strong foundation, you don't have a strong home. If you don't have a strong foundation, you don't have a winning culture. And you mentioned the years in Cleveland, but those were some of our best years relationally with teammates. We had three kids while we were there because there's so much to do in Cleveland in the wintertime. Having three kids in 3 years. But that organization did not have stability. It changed ownership. I had two different coaches in 3 years. I had about five or six or seven different quarterbacks in 3 years. And so when you look at a New England with Mr. Kraft, you look at New Orleans, even Baltimore, what they built there with Harbaugh being there, I think he's probably the longest tenured active coach, him and Mike Tomlin, I believe. Yep. The stability provides an opportunity for a winning culture. And then the accountability that, you know what, I'm sitting there in a meeting room and Bill Belichick is fussing at Tom Brady the same way he's fussing at me, or he's fussing at somebody who's the 53rd person on the roster. That creates the accountability that allows you to win football games, because winning is not easy in the NFL. A lot of people think it is, but it's not a given.
We are talking with former Saints tight end Ben Watson. So many things. Walter Payton, two-time nominee, winner of the Bart Starr Award, which, by the way, Cam Jordan, three-time finalist Walter Payton, and also a nominee for the Bart Starr Award. So you two guys, you know, it's about on the field, but it's about community as well. And
let me tell you something about Cam.
That's where I was going.
My favorite, well, I hate to jump. You asked the question after I get done with this, but I got to tell you something about this guy, about Cam Jordan. In 2018, I'm back with the Saints. We make it all the way to the NFC Championship game. I get appendicitis that week. I told the doctors, I don't want to have surgery because I got to play in this NFC Championship game. They looked at me like I was crazy. Long story short, I'm sitting there in Ochsner Medical Center in the hospital. They give me antibiotics. They're like, it's a miracle I'm healed from my acute appendicitis. But I was unable to play because of roster things. They decided to play somebody else. Anyway, I'm standing there on the sideline before the NFC Championship game starts, and the captains get called to go out. And I'm standing there, obviously emotional, because I wasn't going to be playing in the game. This was a huge deal for us. All of a sudden, I feel somebody pick me up from behind me. Somebody picks me up, walks me a couple yards to the right, places me down, and says, go out there. It's Cam Jordan. He was supposed to go out as a captain. And he's like, no, this means a lot to you. Picks me up, sends me out there in street clothes, just in my sweats, to go to the coin toss in his place. That's the type of person that he is. I don't know where you were going, but when you said Cam Jordan, I was like, I got to tell this story, because honestly, it's one of my favorite stories about him, because we see how good he is as a player. We hear about what he does in the community and all those sorts of things. But that's the type of leader you need in your locker room, somebody who does those little things and is sacrificial in all those ways.
That's exactly where I was going. Anything, with people like yourself and Cam, I just go, Cam. And then Cam goes, or I go, Ben, talk about Cam. And that's what I want. I mean, a story. So all good. So I'm going to talk about three instances of games, and which one is either top of your mind, deep in your heart, stuck in your gut. 2004, you're the Super Bowl, you know, but you're on IR, right? So you, they win, but you're on IR for that year for New England. 2007, Super Bowl, New Orleans is Eli Manning. They win, ruin your undefeated season. And you started to talk about it, the 2018 Saints-Rams no-call game. Of those three kind of, you know, moments, which comes to your – what do you think about most?
Oh, my gosh. Dude, you're like giving me a therapy session right now. I'm actively seeing a therapist to work through all this disappointment that I've had. And I'm going to be able to report to her next week saying, you know, I had an opportunity to use some of the skills that you've given me, because it was brought up in an interview. You said top of your mind, deep in your gut, or
in your, what's in your heart, gut, right? Because they're all different.
You know what? They're all deep in my gut. They're all painful experiences. Not being able to play in the Super Bowl was really hard, because the Super Bowl that we won, I was on the sideline. I felt like I had let my family down. I felt like I let the team down. My fiance, who's my wife of 19 years now, I was a jerk to her and to my family, who just came to support me, because I was so selfish because I couldn't play in the game. And so that was a disappointment. Then we make it back, and we had a chance to have statues built about us, statues built for it. I mean, 18 games straight, and lose by somebody catching the ball on top of their helmet. Like, what is this? And so that was a grave disappointment. But the injustice piece, I think, about the no call is what really, really got me, and why I ended up unretiring and playing another year, is because I couldn't believe that that happened. Like, I couldn't believe in the National Football League, that is the best league in the world, in this country, where, yeah, people are human, people make mistakes, but to have something happen that egregious, when you only get chances, like at that point in time in my career, I'm already in year 15. And, I'm, 38, 37 years old. And you don't get that many chances to do something like that and to have it seemingly stripped away in an unjust fashion. That one sticks the hardest. That one stings the hardest because of the way it went down.
Well, and you fight a lot. You are out there in the public. Public injustice, you're activists, and so yeah, I get it. I get it. So let's brighten it up a little bit. Let's end the session. So in 2018, you caught a touchdown pass from Drew to help beat your former team, the Baltimore Ravens, by a point, 24-23. It was Drew's 500th touchdown pass. Yeah. Where's the ball?
He has it.
He's got so many footballs, he can't have room for it.
I know, it's probably under a bed somewhere, one of his kids. Either he has it or it's in the Saints Museum there in Metairie. But I made sure he kept the ball. I was like, dude, there's no way. And he told me to keep it. No, I said, dude, there's no way I'm keeping number 500. This is yours. So I don't know where it is, but I don't have it.
It's still special though, right? By a point.
it was a goal line play. I believe it was X-Bo, which means that the ex-tight end runs a corner route right there. And, I mean, that was a great game. If you remember that game, we go up there to Baltimore, and I want to say we may have won at the very end of the game on a Justin Tucker missed field goal, which Justin does not miss very many field goals, especially during that season, and caught a touchdown there. I hold up a number 5 at that point for 5 of my kids, but it had a double meaning for number 500. just a special moment. It was a joy, honestly, to play. People ask me a lot, who's better, Brady or Breeze, and all that type of stuff. They're two different people, different personalities. But during that time in New Orleans, Drew and his family, they're just really genuine, special people. And I can remember we both had been married around the same amount of years, had like the same amount of kids at the time. We've since added on to
that. You're killing them now.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, it's not a race. But just one of those guys that I'm grateful that I had an opportunity to share a locker room with.
We'll have more with former Saints tight end Ben Watson, and we'll look at the field of 12 as the college football playoffs get set to begin this weekend. The Saints Hour will continue after this on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. With former Saints tight end Ben Watson, and we will spend the remainder of our time talking college football, SEC analysts. So the college football season begins, the playoff season, the postseason, begins with a bowl game in Atlanta this past weekend, December 14th, and then it ends on January 20th, also in Atlanta, 45 games in between. Initially, did you secretly pick a bracket, and did you pick a winner?
Well, you know what my winner is going to be.
I know. I figured
my
so.
My winner is the Georgia Bulldogs. And, it's not that far of a reach. It's not really a homer pick because Georgia could legitimately win. I think that this year, what I've seen this year in college football, and for those that watch, it is there hasn't been just that dominant team. Maybe one or two teams that you would say. I mean, the Oregon, I think, is in a class probably by themselves when I look at the landscape. But there have been flashes of brilliance from all these other teams, whether it's Georgia or Texas, Notre Dame, even Tennessee, Ohio State, obviously. There have been flashes of brilliance 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks in a row, and then you'll see one of the teams trip up in a, unreasonable loss or something you can't explain, like an Ohio State losing to Michigan. There's those sorts of things that have happened. And so I think for college football fans, it's been an exciting season. There's the first time there's a 12-team playoff. You see some teams in there like an SMU that, you know, who would have thought they would be in there. But there's also an idea that everybody kind of has a chance because nobody's really been super consistent throughout the whole season.
Do you like the format or do you feel already just because – I mean, you got the byes, you got some teams maybe not wanting to play in their conference championship games. I mean, does it feel like it's, yeah, it was, hey, we had to get here, but already maybe some tweaks in it?
You know, I don't know what the tweaks are going to be. I think they're going to be some, but this is the thing. In Division I, you know, FBS college football, there's always going to be this what if for whoever's on the fringe. And so when it was a 4-team playoff, it was, you know, number five, number six. Why didn't they get in? Remember last year, Georgia goes undefeated. They're losing their SEC championship. They're out. Florida State, you know, goes undefeated, wins the ACC, and the quarterback gets hurt, and they're out. And so there's always the teams on the fringe that have an argument to be in. Before that, you had the BCS where it's just picked who the two teams were. Now we have a 12-team playoff, which models more towards getting a true champion. But in my opinion, until we go to an NFL model, which, you know, perhaps may happen in college football, you're seeing other things happen in college football where players are getting paid through revenue sharing and through NIL. There's kind of more of a pro style right now when it comes to that, at least it's leaning that way. You're not really going to get a true champion. There's always going to be some sort of argument. Why didn't this team get in? Why didn't that team get in? So will there be changes? Yes. In the next couple of years, there's going to be some changes, but it's still going to be an imperfect system until you're able to get that type of division type representation that we see across the league.
All right. About 4 minutes left and we'll let you go because I know you got a hard out. So let's want to talk about the games that kind of impact us here in New Orleans. So you got number 10, Indiana at number 7, Notre Dame. That game, and then Georgia gets that winner. Indiana, what a year for them. You know, how do you look at Indiana and Notre Dame and then kind of whoever has to face Georgia?
Yeah, Indiana, you know, it was crazy. Being in the SEC network, you don't get to watch a lot of these other teams until this time of year. And, you know, I had an opportunity to look a little bit at Indiana, just a well-coached, tough physical football team that they do a lot of things well. But then on Notre Dame's side, Notre Dame – their running attack is what's going to determine this football game. Indiana's been good against the run. I think they have that like number one rushing defense, but going against a Notre Dame team that runs the ball very well. The question is, how do each of those teams stack up against Georgia? One thing I think Georgia does well, even though their defense has not been what it has been in the past, that they play well against the run. Look at the Texas game, the SEC championship. Quintrivion Weisner, the running back for Texas, came into that game averaging about over 100 yards over the last games before the SEC championship. Georgia shut him down. And so I think that plays into Georgia's hands, getting two teams that like to run the football, because that's what I think Georgia does well. The question I think that we'll see in the Sugar Bowl for Georgia is, you know, who's going to be a quarterback?
Yeah,
Carson Beck, the starting quarterback, gets hurt in the SEC championship. Gunnar Stockton, the backup, comes in. He takes a big shot, and then Carson Beck comes in the very end of the game. And so over these next couple of weeks, I think Coach Kirby Smart and Coach Mike Bobo, the offensive coordinator, are going to have plenty of time to formulate a plan that tailors to Gunnar Stockton if he ends up playing his strengths and weaknesses. But I think that's the biggest question offensively for Georgia, because they've been up and down offensively. The defense, I think, is going to rise to the occasion against either one of those teams.
Well, finally, you started Duke. You transferred to Georgia. You lose a complete year of eligibility back then, right?
And more pain.
No. But if the new system is in, first off, you get NIL money to go to Georgia. You don't lose a year. You get drafted by New England in 2003. You win the title in 2003 on the field. It's impactful.
And I'm a year younger too.
Right. Exactly. And so I went to James Madison University. And by the way, that's where Kurt Cicchetti, you know, was before he went to Indiana. So
that's where a lot of the players came from.
Convince me college football in the final minute here is going in the right direction. 5 years from now, like, this thing is a train going 100 miles an hour.
The NIL, I think it was, this all could have been prevented. And when I was in college, I remember going to football games, our games, seeing people in the stands wearing jerseys of different of my teammates, and we couldn't get a sandwich for free, much less get paid for anything. Like,
where'd you get that laundry money?
The imbalance, people were crying out for this to be addressed, and NCAA kicked the can down the road so much so that now the floodgates are wide open through court cases, and now we're trying to reel it all back. I love the fact that players have agency. I love the fact that a player, much like a coach, can go to another team. It's tough for fans to look at that, but at the same time, I believe these guys should have the agency to be able to make these types of decisions. I love the fact that they're being compensated, because when you look at the amount of money that and revenue that college football brings in, look, is the players deserve a share of that. I love that. What I don't like is the fact that now there are people, there are characters that are taking advantage of players, promising them certain things, perhaps lying to them about what they can get them. And that's impacting players' decisions to make moves. That has to be curtailed. That has to be monitored. And so, look, is it going in the right direction? I don't know, but this is the direction that it's going. I think that the best thing for us to do is to try to create some guardrails over it, because the essence of the game is still there. Players want to win. Players want to compete. But there need to be the guardrails, which is why so many of us get a little uncomfortable about the way that it's going.
It is the Watson 7 Foundation. Ben Watson, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time. Hope to see you in New Orleans soon.
Yes, sir. Hope to be there.
My thanks to Ben Watson and Mickey Loomis for their time earlier today. Ben and I spent a little time talking about Cam Jordan and the impact that Cam had on Ben. We didn't get to talk a lot about another record-setting day for the 2011 first-round pick, who seems to come alive in December and January.
Third down and 18. Ball is back to the Commander 31. We need to get to the Commander 47. Saints bring four. Daniel steps up. He's in trouble, and he's going to go down again. Cam Jordan with the sack inside the 20. Picked him up, brought him down, wrestling style.
Nice rush by Chase Young.
Yep.
Chase Young forces him to come back into the pocket. Cam Jordan is playing defensive tackle, and Cam sees it. He's not getting too far up the field. Cam is able to get the sack. That's a nice series by the Saints defensive line.
In the second quarter, that sack of Jaden Daniels forced Washington to punt, and Daniels became the 48th different quarterback sacked by Cam Jordan. But Cam wasn't through. In the third quarter, with the Commanders trying to go up 21-0 on their first third quarter drive, Washington faced a third and goal from the 1 yard line, but guess who? Blasted through.
Another double digit drive for Washington. 10th play, but it's a third and goal from the one. Robinson deep, Daniels under center. Fakes it. Saints play it well. Cam Jordan's going to get the sack at the 5 yard line. His second of the day. Cam Jordan is not fooled. Got some penetration. Got the sack. Sixth officially.
Yeah, I'm looking for this all game. I mean, because they're trying to say, hey, we're going to run it. We're going to run it. But those defensive ends, I'm looking for that all game. And so the guy that's probably upset himself is Granderson, because he was the one that had a similar play, but Cam would not allow Jaden out of his grasp.
On the day, Jordan had six tackles, three of them solo, and the two sacks for a loss of 11 yards. His two-sack performance was his 28th multi-sack game, setting a new franchise record as Jordan now surpasses Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2010 linebacker Ricky Jackson. Jordan now has 120.5 sacks for his career, and the Saints with a season-high 8 sacks against Washington. Cam's teammate and the other 35-year-old player on this Saints defense, DeMario Davis, also continued an impressive streak of his own. Davis finished with a season-high 14 tackles, 9 solo, including 1 sack and 2 tackles for a loss. His 10th tackle against Washington gave him 100 tackles on the season, which he has done all seven seasons in New Orleans, eight straight seasons. If you go back to 2017, his last year with the New York Jets, and 11 times in his 13-year amazing career. And now with Atlanta's win last night in Las Vegas, the math is now simple. Not pretty, just simple. The Saints need to win their final three games and hope that both Atlanta and Tampa Bay lose their final three. Each will play on Sunday, so the Saints will know at least where they stand for the time being when they play their game on Monday night. My thanks to Charlie Long in the booth, and thanks for listening, everyone. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.